Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of the most critical aspects of surgical management of this disease is the patient with hepatic-only metastases, and as you're about to hear, finally, a major North American Phase 3 trial is about to be launched evaluating management of these patients. Dr. Nick Petrelli has had a central role in the evolution of this study, and to obtain a better perspective on the practical clinical management of these patients, I asked him to present several patients from his practice, and he began with a man who developed disease recurrence after primary surgery for what was considered a low-risk lesion.
This was a 62-year-old white male who was about 2 years post a left hemicolectomy for what turned out to be at that time a stage 2 colon cancer. Patient had no poor prognostic factors on that stage 2 colon cancer and at the time did not want to go on to a clinical trial. And after further discussion, no adjuvant chemotherapy was offered to the patient. So the patient was followed since that time period. Had a serial rise in CEA, which justified looking for something that may not be quite right, and underwent a CT scan, which revealed about a 3-centimeter lesion in bismuth segment 3 of the liver, so lateral segment or left lobe of the liver.
So before we go any farther, I want to ask you about actually his initial presentation when he was at his, quote, stage 2 lesion. I take it, did you do that surgery incidentally?
Yes.
And how many nodes were removed?
There were 25 nodes that were removed.
And can you tell me a little bit more about the primary lesion and the pathology?
Yeah, this was a moderately to well-differentiated adenocarcinoma, 0 of 25 nodes, 25 were cleared, no nodes were positive. There was no perineurovascular or lymphatic invasion, and this was not an obstructing lesion. He had been getting colonoscopy since he was 50 years old, so this was an individual who was pretty compliant in his surveillance.
And now, was this a T3 or T4 lesion?
This was a T3 lesion, yes. T3 N0 M0.
Just a couple of things looking back. First of all, you say he was compliant with the colonoscopy guidelines, and yet he still gets diagnosed with an invasive tumor. What do we know about that question in terms of detecting lesions before they're actually invasive or malignant?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head. I mean, this was a compliant individual. I guess the answer to that question, Neil, is that we don't know as much as we think we know. Yeah, this was an individual that, despite compliance, showed up with a stage 2 colon cancer. I think it's going to get back to the gene profiling that someday we will be able to select out individuals like this and say, look, you're destined for this before this occurs. It looks like colonoscopy may not be the answer. Perhaps there should be chemotherapeutic agents that we will use in the future or even like we do in HMPCC, prophylactic colectomies.
Or maybe you can just take this pill for the next couple of years. It has no side effects and it'll prevent you from getting it.
Sure. Absolutely.
And obviously, we're not very close to that. What kind of work did he do or does he do?
This was an individual who was basically a blue-collar worker. He was actually a tailor. Worked in one of the men's shops and was a tailor in the men's shop.
Interesting. And was he married?
Yes, he was married.
Kids?
No children.
And were they as a couple or he as a patient when you first started to encounter him, were they the kind of people who were out on the web trying to find out information or they kind of left everything up to you?
No, they kind of came in with information, especially after the surgery. You know, they had come in about the possibility of giving treatment afterwards, chemotherapy afterwards. They had information about the controversy of this. They were pretty well informed when they came in. My job was to really give them the advantages and disadvantages of explaining this to them, and they were part of a multidisciplinary team, so I had kind of set the stage, and then as part of our multidisciplinary team, the medical oncologist had also spoken to them. But when all was said and done, because he did not have any of the high-risk prognostic factors, and because he didn't want to go on a clinical trial, in my mind and in the medical oncologist's mind, he had made the right decision. Now, you know, when they came back with the serial rise, one of their questions obviously was, well, you think, Dr. Petrelli, if we had gotten chemotherapy after surgery that, you know, this would have prevented the liver metastasis? And of course, there's no way of knowing that.
Right. And I hear from docs a lot about this idea of, quote, not leaving any stone unturned. So maybe they had a little question about whether or not they'd really done everything they could. But in that initial meeting, did he actually ask you for any numbers?
Well, a little bit. I had told him that when you look at stage two, overall stage two colon cancer, I didn't separate it out into T3 or T4. But when you looked at that, the overall survival was close to 80% without any chemotherapy alone. Of course, I could have given him the benefit in stage three, but, you know, the benefit in stage two, I didn't give him because we don't know that because of the lack of the power of the studies.
So, in other words, if he had said to you, could you tell me what your best estimate is of the chance that I'm going to have a relapse of this cancer, what number would you have given him?
Oh, I would have told them that, you know, the chances of relapse would have been very small and probably would have been around under 10% with so many nodes cleared, no poor prognostic factors. So here's an individual who, you know, was not on the top of the bell curve.
Okay. So, but if he said, okay, you're saying it's less than 10%, that sounds really good. If I take chemo, will it go down at all?
Yeah, it will. You know, not a dramatic percent. He didn't ask that question, but certainly it probably will. Again, we don't know in stage two, but it probably would. And I think in view of the fact that we don't have enough data with this, this is an estimate that you have to make.
To me, I thought things kind of changed very recently at ASCO Orlando, and you were part of that whole effort looking at oncotype and colon cancer. I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think the NSABP has been working real hard on this with SoonPeg and the colorectal group trying to mimic what was done with oncotype and breast. And as you know, the results of that showed that it is prognostic, but it didn't help in terms of response to therapy. But there's no question that this is the beginning of gene profiling in colon and rectal cancer. And I think we're going to see this dramatically improve over the next 5 to 10 years.
In any event, so this man maybe theoretically left a percent or two on the table, but statistically, probably this was going to happen either way. So now there's a lesion in the liver. Can you talk about sort of how you assess this and what you were thinking at that point?
Sure. Well, as my former fellows will know, the first thing I do, number one, this man certainly was a candidate for surgical resection. He was otherwise in good health, had never been hospitalized before except for his hemicolectomy a couple of years ago. In the usual things, he was on no major medications, no allergies. So discussion centered around the potential way of curing him from this metastasis was with surgical resection. And I explained that this lesion, pending another test, was indeed surgically resectable. And that would be determined, obviously, at the time of surgery with a couple of things. I like to find a reason not to operate on people like this. So one of the things that we did was we did a PET scan. Not so much for what was going on in the liver itself, but I wanted to make sure that there was nothing going on extrahepatically because unless a patient's on a trial with extrahepatic disease, in my mind, that's a contraindication to resection. So his PET scan didn't show any evidence of extrahepatic disease. And then I did mention to him that although I was optimistic, one of the other things aside from a good exploratory ciliotomy to rule out extrahepatic disease, we would also do an intraoperative ultrasound of the liver because in about 10% of patients, even though the CT scan doesn't show additional lesions, you'll find additional lesions in about 10% of people. And with this particular individual, remember, we didn't offer adjuvant chemotherapy after his colon. He had good prognostic factors. So you could imagine after this surgery, their first question was, doctor, do I need anything after this? And as you know, as we've talked before, I'm an advocate in an otherwise healthy individual for giving the chemotherapy after hepatic resection rather than before.
Although certainly there are a lot of investigators who believe, particularly those I think in Europe, of using pre-op therapy.
Oh, absolutely. Perioperative. I mean, Bernard Nornlinger in the EORTC trial, you were there at ASCO in 2007. Very nice presentation by Bernard. We're at two ends of the spectrum on this. We just had a nice debate at ASCO this year about this, adjuvant versus perioperative. I think that trial certainly can convince individuals to give it perioperatively. I just feel that because of the hepatic toxicity, until we have a trial of perioperative versus adjuvant, I have recommended to patients to get it after their surgery.
Just to clarify, when you talk about perioperative therapy, you're talking about therapy before surgery, but also these patients, I would assume they're also going to get post-op therapy?
Yeah, the EORTC trial gave several cycles before surgery and then several cycles afterwards. And I think that's important for surgeons who are listening. we have to get our definitions straight. When we talk about resectable hepatic metastasis, we basically use three terms. The first term is adjuvant, and that's giving systemic therapy after hepatic resection. The second is perioperative chemotherapy, and that's giving several cycles before surgery, during the resection, and then giving several cycles after surgery. And then there's neoadjuvant, and that's kind of been lumped with perioperative. Neoadjuvant is really giving the chemotherapy prior to surgery and then possibly consideration afterwards, not necessarily. But that's kind of been lumped in with perioperative in the hepatic metastasis arena.
So let's track out sort of the pluses and minuses just very, very briefly of both approaches. In terms of your thoughts in terms of waiting until after surgery in a patient like this presents, very straightforward, surgically resectable, what are you thinking? You want to avoid hepatic toxicity from systemic therapy?
Yeah. You know, this was a two-centimeter lesion or so in the lateral segment of the left lobe. That's probably one of the most safest operations to do in liver. It allows one to get a full exploration of the abdominal cavity to make sure there's no extrahepatic disease. It allows you to do the intraoperative ultrasound that we talked about. So I'm operating on a normal liver, except for the hepatic lesion. I'm operating on a normal liver. This was not a cirrhotic. He was not a diabetic. He was not obese. When you give the chemotherapy preoperatively, and as you know today, it's either oxaliplatinum with 5-FU-leucovorin or irinotecan, we know that there are certain effects on the normal liver parenchyma that can happen. We know that with irinotecan, you can get steatohepatitis. We know that with oxaliplatinum, you can get sinusoidal dilatation and obstruction, and that's in the normal liver. And in the EORTC trial that Dr. Nordlinger was the PI on, there were postoperative complications that were serious complications and that were increased statistically so as opposed to the second arm of that trial, which was surgery alone.
So did this patient get into the level of detail of understanding that there was a controversy about this?
Oh, yes. We discussed that more so than the controversy of stage 2 colon cancer. I mean, I explained to him the data in the EORTC trial, which I think is very necessary, and then explained some of the trials that have shown an advantage of giving it postoperatively, but admitted to him that the one thing we don't have today is a trial that compares perioperative to adjuvant. I told him that his disease-free survival would be better with postoperative chemotherapy than surgery alone, and that that difference in disease-free survival was around 9 or 10%. That's been shown both with the perioperative and with the adjuvant. Now, that's disease-free survival. That's not overall survival, because none of the trials have had the power to show a difference in overall survival. Although one of the adjuvant trials with hepatic metastasis did show a trend towards that. We had talked about disease-free survival.
So if he were to ask you, what's the chance if I do the surgery, I do the post-op chemo, what's the chance that it's going to come back anyhow?
I told him that in a certain time period, there was probably a 90% chance that it wouldn't come back with the chemotherapy over a 5-year period.
What about the other side of the debate in terms of favoring pre-op? What I've heard from them is if you don't give too much chemo, it really doesn't hurt the liver that much. And this way, you kind of allow the disease to declare itself. You're talking about seeing whether or not other meths show up, try to shrink it down a little bit. What do you think about those kinds of arguments?
Yeah, I think those are all good arguments. I mean, let's mention a couple of these. One is that when you give the chemotherapy, if you see a response, remember, we're talking about resectable disease. So we're not talking about conversion chemotherapy here. So these are patients that all have resectable disease. So if the patient wants perioperative chemotherapy and you give them preoperative chemotherapy, chemotherapy prior to resection, and you see a response, gee, that's even more enthusiasm to give that same chemotherapy following hepatic resection. So you're kind of using an in vivo testing with that perioperative or preoperative chemotherapy to tell a patient, you know, you're still resectable here and the lesions have gotten smaller, so after surgery, we're going to continue the same chemotherapy. And I think that's a good argument for perioperative chemotherapy. On the other side of the coin, that chemotherapy, as I said, is affecting the normal liver. So you hit the nail on the head, Neil. We know that the more chemotherapy, the more cycles you give, the higher that morbidity is going to be. And in general, you like to stay within 6 cycles of chemotherapy. You start getting higher, and then you're affecting that normal liver even more, and that morbidity postoperatively is going to increase. So yes, the more chemotherapy you give beyond probably six or more cycles, the higher the morbidity. On the other side of the coin, it acts as an in vivo response mechanism for that patient to see, hey, this is great. I can give the same chemotherapy postoperatively.
Can you talk about what actually happened to this man?
Yeah, after discussion for his surgery, showing PET scan showing no extrahepatic disease, he went to surgery. Intraoperative ultrasound did not show any other lesions. He did not have any other lesions, especially in the porta hepatis or extrahepatically at the time of exploratory ciliotomy. And he underwent a left lateral segmentectomy, did very well, got out of the hospital in about 5 days, no postoperative complications, and then came back to the office with the multidisciplinary team. And you can imagine he came back basically saying, Doc, I feel great, but I want that chemotherapy. And so he was given 6 months of FOLFOX because he had not had previous adjuvant chemotherapy and has done very, very well.
One of the issues in managing these people, both pre-op and post-op, is the use of biologics. And in colon cancer, we have two major classes, the EGFR antibodies, cetuximab and panitumumab, and the anti-VEGF agent, bevacizumab or Avastin. What do we know about using these agents in the pre-op and post-op setting?
As you know, the EORTC trial was FOLFOX alone, and other trials following hepatic resection have used chemotherapy alone. We certainly know what the effect of some of these targeted agents are in the advanced disease setting, unresectable disease. And as you know from the Cairo 2 study and the PACE study, we now know that two targeted agents are not necessarily better than one targeted agent. The next EORTC trial is going to be looking at targeted agents, and the NSABP trial is going to be looking at targeted agents with bevacizumab with chemotherapy in the perioperative and the adjuvant setting.
So why don't we talk about those two trials then?
Well, I'll talk about the NSABP trial. I'm happy to report that the NSABP has approved that trial. It is, as we speak, being written with its details. We hope to get it back to the NCI and hopefully by the end of this year, early next year, start accruing to the trial. As we mentioned before, with all this controversy about perioperative versus adjuvant, we have not had a trial comparing those two. The perioperative trial of EORTC compared it to surgery alone, and the adjuvant trials have compared it to surgery alone. The NSABP trial will not have a limit as to the number of metastases. We can get into that a little bit later. These would be resectable patients. They will be candidates for surgery. We are not allowing ablative procedures as part of the potentially curative resection, so it's only surgical procedures per se for the main lesions. And then patients will be randomized to either perioperative treatment or adjuvant treatment. The perioperative treatment will consist of either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI with bevacizumab. If they have gotten FOLFOX as an adjuvant, then they will be getting FOLFIRI in this trial along with bevacizumab perioperatively and then continue that after hepatic resection. If they get randomized to surgery first, they obviously will get the surgery first and then postoperatively either get FOLFOX or FOLFIRI with bevacizumab, depending on if they got FOLFOX in the adjuvant setting for their colon surgery. This trial will require about 600 patients, and as I said, we hope to get it going by the end of this year, sometime early next year.
So for surgeons who haven't seen that many patients with bevacizumab or Avastin, maybe we can talk a little bit about what it is. And I guess the question I've got to ask you, because this is kind of news to me that this trial is about to get up and running, and you'll explain why this is kind of an important question, is how long are you going to give the bevacizumab?
Bevacizumab is a vascular endothelial growth factor inhibitor. It's an anti-angiogenic agent. It's been shown in the advanced unresectable disease setting in combination with chemotherapy to improve overall survival to the point now where patients with unresectable colorectal cancer are living beyond 2 years, almost 2.5 years in some series.
I guess we should talk, too, a little bit about how much side effects and toxicity bring in bevacizumab and potentially could bring. I guess the one issue, of course, is the issue of wound healing. And breast cancer, bevacizumab, is being used in a lot of the NSABP trials, and they kind of keep about a six-week interval between the Bev and any kind of surgery. Is that the way you're approaching this?
Yeah, because of the half-life of bevacizumab, we have recommended that surgeons wait at least 6 to 8 weeks if a patient has had bevacizumab, which brings up an important point about the NSABP trial. The last dose of bevacizumab prior to surgery and the first dose of bevacizumab after surgery, after hepatic resection, will be held in this particular trial because of those concerns. But you're right on target, Neil. In an individual in general, a patient who has had bevacizumab who's going to surgery, the key here is because of the long half-life, wait 6 to 8 weeks before that surgery is performed.
And I know you just had a letter in the Journal of Clinical Oncology addressing this issue. I think there was an MD Anderson series looking at this exact issue of Bev and surgery. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think Nick Vote and Lee Ellis at MD Anderson have done a great job in looking at not only chemotherapy and its effect on liver, but bevacizumab. And I think they've shown very nicely that you can do safe surgery with bevacizumab if you go ahead and wait that 6 to 8 week period. Otherwise, you get what we call these livers that bleed. You know, livers bleed to begin with, but you have increased bleeding. You have this effect of wound healing that's been shown, and you want to avoid that since liver surgery is major surgery that can be fought with a lot of complications just with surgery alone. So you don't want to add on to that with some of these newer targeted agents. So Nick Vote and Lee Ellis have shown some very nice data that it is safe if you wait that 6 to 8 week period.
And I guess one thing about the adjuvant study, and I guess we've seen this in metastatic disease too, is that, and you were actually on the safety paper for the adjuvant study, is in terms of side effects. What I've heard is that, I mean, since it's an antibody, bevacizumab kind of doesn't usually make people feel bad, but they can run into hypertension, proteinuria, nosebleeds, increased arteriovenous events to some extent. What's your overall take of how much side effects and toxicity Bev brings into this kind of situation?
Well, I think in this situation, when we're talking about, you know, potentially curable disease, and we're talking about patients who are otherwise healthy, I think despite the side effects that you've mentioned, Neil, we know that those are not common. We know that the hypertension can be controlled. We know that bowel perforation, hemorrhage from the primary, you know, are rare events. As long as we're aware of those and we're doing it in a safe environment like this trial, I think this is the way to do it. And we'll certainly find out in the NSABP trial. We're very interested in the toxicity of what occurs, not only with the bevacizumab, but with the agents that we're using, FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, in this prospective environment.
Now, a lot of people have heard about the bowel perforations that have occurred with bevacizumab, but in the adjuvant setting, it looked like there were very few. What do we know about the whole issue of bowel perforations and bevacizumab?
Well, I think the NSABP CO8, in my mind, that was one of the most important aspects of CO8. The toxicity of bevacizumab in CO8 was not toxicity that was not unexpected, and it was toxicity that was very, very doable. And off the top of my head, Neil, I don't think there was one bowel perforation in NSABP CO8. So to me, that was a major, major step forward of the safety of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting if in the future we're going to continue with that targeted agent.
So now this man, how far out is he since he's had his surgery?
He is about 2.5 to 3 years out.
What do we know about the time course of recurrence in this situation?
Well, we know that the highest recurrences in a situation like this are going to be within a 3 to 5 year period. So he's getting close to that 3 year period, may just be over that 3 year period. But certainly in this disease site, we know that that's the scenario.
Let's go on to your second patient, the 65-year-old woman.
Yes, this was an interesting case. This is a 65-year-old white female who presented with an asymptomatic sigmoid colon cancer proven on colonoscopy with unresectable hepatic metastasis. She was performance status 1 and was otherwise in good health. So you can imagine the discussion here, which centered around, number one, what do we do globally? And number two, what do we do about the liver metastasis and what do we do about the sigmoid colon carcinoma?
Now, what was it exactly that was making these hepatic metastases unresectable?
Oh, she had lesions that were scattered throughout all lobes of the liver, probably around 20 lesions or so that we could at least see on imaging. There was no way that you could safely remove those and leave functional liver behind.
Now, how did you get involved with her? You did the biopsy?
No. She actually came to our multidisciplinary center and was seen by a team. And the reason for that was that the primary care physician who had worked her up had seen these liver metastases and rightly so had figured that these were not resectable, but what about the primary tumor? And so we felt this had to be a multidisciplinary approach.
And of course, this exact situation is something the NSABP has been very interested in. You all have had a phase 2 study, NSABP C10, looking at these exact patients with asymptomatic primary tumors and mets. Can you talk about that study, the background of it, and sort of what you're doing?
I think this phase 2 study is going to make an impact one way or the other in this question about what do you do with patients who present with a non-obstructing, non-perforating, non-hemorrhagic colon cancer, but they have unresectable distant metastasis. In the past, as you know, and certainly in my training in the past, in the 70s and early 80s, we were trained that that primary had to be removed because patients would get into problems with obstruction and perforation, and then you're operating on somebody emergently, and their morbidity would be even higher. What we've come to realize is that with the newer agents we have been talking about in the last half hour or so, that there have been tremendous response rates with these agents, and there's been an improvement in overall survival in the unresectable advanced disease setting. So the question that has arisen is it necessary to remove those primary cancers? And there's tremendous controversy in the literature. There's two schools of thought. The first school of thought is, no, you got to remove that primary because even with the newer agents that we have today, you know, we just talked about bowel perforation with some of these agents. These patients may get obstructed and now you're operating on them. They may have to get a colostomy because it's an emergency operation. And then there's a second school of thought that says, well, no, you know, these patients have a great response to these newer chemotherapeutic agents. Why can't we save these patients an operation?
It's really a palliative issue of trying to prevent them. I mean, they are destined to die of their disease, trying to prevent them from having to go through this morbid experience.
Right. They're going to end up dying with their primary intact. Why put them through an operation that may be forth with complications?
I always thought C10 was a fantastic study, even though, you know, it's not going to really cure anybody. But from a creative point of view and a palliative point of view, I always thought it was a great trial. Where are you right now with that?
Well, I'm happy to report that the last patient was accrued in June of this year. The target was 90 patients. It was a Simon design so that as a phase 2, with the first 30 or so patients or first 20 or so patients, the trial would have been stopped if there were problems with obstruction or perforation, but none of that occurred. So we went ahead, targeted the 90 patients. That last patient was put on in June. And so I would say by the end of this year, we will have the definitive results of that trial, and we'll be able to either reinforce the PATI data that was presented at ASCO this year or refute that data. And I think one way or the other, this phase 2 trial is going to really make an impact on, quote, the standard of care, which is two schools of thought.
So you don't have any data right now in terms of number of complications?
No, because the last patient was put on in June. We're looking at all this data right now, looking at the details of it, because these are not easy patients to decide. You know, obviously, some of these patients went to surgery. Some of them went to surgery because they got such a dramatic response in their livers that they went for resection. So we have to tease that out. And by the end of the year, we'll have the results of that trial.
We're all looking forward to that. But, you know, there was that paper that was presented, you just referred to, by Patey for Memorial. Can you comment on that? Because I thought that was fascinating. Now, that wasn't a prospective study like what you're doing in the NSABP, but it was still the same patients.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to moderate Dr. Patey's presentation at ASCO this year. This was a series of patients, 233 patients, where a prospective database was looked at in terms of patients that presented with primary colon and rectum. I might add, Neil, that rectum was included in this report also. In the NSABP trial, we only looked at colon. And what Patey showed was that these were patients that had unresectable disease. They were relatively asymptomatic with their primary colon or rectal cancer. They received chemotherapy in the modern era, and 93% of them never required surgery. Only 7% acquired emergency surgery, so the overwhelming majority of these patients were spared surgery because of the agents that we have today.
You know, it's interesting looking at that because as I've been talking to investigators, both surgeons as well as medical oncologists over the last, I'd say, 5 years, I've been hearing more and more about people just going ahead and doing this because they had seen that it worked, that they could get these people through without the surgery. And that's kind of, I guess, what these patients were. They were people taking care of Memorial where they just went ahead and did this. And I guess there was patient selection involved, obviously. But as you point out, almost all these people were able to avoid primary surgery.
Yeah, and I think that shift, even at Memorial, was due to the fact you have people like, you know, Nancy Kemeny, Len Saltz working very hard in the clinical trials arena, showing that, look, we're getting responses and results in the advanced disease setting that we didn't even see in the 5-FU leucovorin era. So if these patients are presenting with small asymptomatic colon cancers, why do we have to resect these and put these patients through an operation?
You know, it's funny. We just had a renal cell cancer think tank, and I was trying to talk them into trying to look at this issue. You know, they had nephrectomy in patients like this that's really ingrained. I think they had a couple randomized trials, but that was sort of in the days before they had all these agents. And I don't know. They seem kind of resistant to the idea. Maybe they need to talk to you guys about it.
You're right. I mean, we're seeing the same thing in renal cell that we hadn't seen in decades before. So I remember the era where surgeons thought that giving chemotherapy after a mastectomy wasn't the thing to do. So sometimes it takes people time to come around.
Right. And of course, again, I think it's really important to clarify, we're not talking about people, whether it's renal or colon or rectum, that are symptomatic from their primaries. These are patients who are asymptomatic.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, there were strict criteria in this phase 2 NSABP trial to make sure that these patients were asymptomatic and didn't have obstructing lesions of the colon.
So what happened with this woman?
So this lady, through discussions, actually went through, was placed on C10 and is one of the patients that is on C10. And I can tell you, since our team was taking care of her, she has done very well and didn't require a resection of her primary tumor.
How long has it been since she was diagnosed?
She is out 2 years.
And she's still asymptomatic?
She's still asymptomatic, yeah.
Do you know what kind of chemo and or biologic she's received?
She was placed on FOLFOX with bevacizumab.
Any issues, hypertension, proteinuria?
Yes, she was treated for hypertension. But in thinking back, that was the main thing, some proteinuria as we expected. But otherwise, you know, no, quote, I'm knocking on wood here, Neil, no bowel perforation, no obstruction, no hemorrhage, no fistula formation. That's the other thing we worry about in these patients. So she's done very well so far.
And she also, the hypertension was easy to control?
Yes. Yes, it was easy to control.
Yeah, that's what we hear from most people. The other thing that I've been hearing from oncologists more about bevacizumab too is nosebleeds. I mean, not real bad usually, but some. Did she have anything like that?
No, she didn't. But that's interesting because it's scarier for the patient, obviously, than it is for the physician.
Right.
No nosebleeds on her, no.
Okay. So how about your last patient, the 58-year-old man?
Yeah, well, the last one, even Dr. Nordlinger would be proud. This is a 58-year-old African-American male who is 4 years out from a right hemicolectomy, again, for a stage 2 cecal cancer. No poor prognostic factors. And again, in view of recent discussions, didn't receive any adjuvant chemotherapy. But another stage 2 where a serial rise in CEA was followed up with a CT scan, which showed several strategically located what appeared to be metastases, especially involving right at the takeoff of the right hepatic and the middle hepatic vein, right smack in the middle of those two, right at the entrance into the vena cava. And so there were some real issues here. You know, I'm an advocate for surgery first, but there are some real issues here about being able to get a good margin on a patient like this.
Let me tell you my very simplified non-surgeon's interpretation of what I see going on in terms of management of patients with liver mets. Tell me if I made it too simple. It seems what I hear are people looking at two issues in terms of whether or not patients are theoretically surgically resectable. One, if you take everything out with margins, are you going to have enough viable normal liver left? And two, is it abutting on something that makes surgery technically difficult / impossible?
Yeah, I think you summarized it very nicely. I mean, the issue here is you want an R0 resection.
So this, but in terms of actual bulk of tumor and bulk of liver you'd have to take out, that would have been okay?
Yeah, it wasn't the amount of normal liver that was taken up by tumor was the strategic location of the lesions.
Now, of course, in this situation, the question comes up, could you convert the person? Could you pull this lesion back so that the surgery could happen? What was your take on that question when you first saw this man?
Yeah, this is how the discussion was centered around this particular individual. When the CT scans were looked at, there was a back and forth. You know, this looks very close. This one lesion was very strategically located. There was a concern about a margin. You're working up in that area, which is a precarious area to begin with, right at the inflow track of where the right and the middle enter into the vena cava. So there was a real concern about a positive margin in a resection like this.
What was this man's state of mind? What kind of work did he do? And what was his family support?
His family support was outstanding. He was actually a lawyer, very well educated, didn't come in with too much information, had a lot of information about his previous surgery and the reasons why chemotherapy wasn't given because of the prognostic factors. But I think was a little shocked that 4 years later, he comes in and he's got disease now in his liver and we're questioning whether we can resect it or not.
Now, one of the things from the point of view of medical oncologists is that a lot of things changed in terms of colon cancer systemic treatment at the 2008 June ASCO meeting when the KRAS data, and we'll talk about that, was presented. But when did this happen relevant to that? Was that before or after that?
That was before.
So at that point, now patients like this would have their tumor tested for KRAS. If the tumor is KRAS mutant, then we would rule out cetuximab. And I guess that's what, about 40% of the patients?
Yeah.
And so here, of course, you didn't have that. What kind of systemic therapy? I assume you gave him systemic therapy to try to shrink it down.
Yeah, so the discussion centered around that. And now we're talking about what we mentioned very briefly a little while ago, and that is now we're not talking about perioperative or adjuvant. We're talking about conversion chemotherapy. And at that time, we were into the FOLFOX scenario. So he received 5-FU leucovorin and oxaliplatinum.
Any biologic?
No biologic. After the third cycle, he had a dramatic decrease in the size of this one strategically located lesion where we felt we could do a formal right hepatic lobectomy. I think the important thing here is, Neil, when we reviewed this, our medical oncologist was saying, well, this is a great response. Let's keep giving the chemotherapy and see if we can get an even better response. Two issues that I think are important to mention here. Remember, we talked about, you know, the more chemotherapy, the more chances you have of increased morbidity. And two, even if you get a complete imaging response, again, our European colleagues have shown that in about 80% of those people, when you operate on them, they still have viable tumor in the liver. So the issue here is once those patients are converted from unresectable to resectable, then that's the time period to take them to surgery. Don't keep pushing.
So how is it that you were able to determine whether or not it shrunk enough for you to do the surgery?
You know, you have your original CT scan, and then it was decided after a couple of cycles we would repeat it to see what direction we're going in. You got one of two things. You're either going to have stable disease where you'd continue the chemotherapy, a response that you still needed some more chemotherapy, or a response that converted it into resectable. Or your other option was that he progressed and now he's definitely not a candidate for resection. He was fortunate enough to have a response where he's converted to resectable disease.
So where is he right now? He had the thing taken out or he had the lesions? How many lesions were there?
He had a total of 5 lesions on that right side, no other lesions. And again, at the time of intraoperative ultrasound, there were no lesions in the medial segment or the lateral segment of the left lobe, no extrahepatic disease. And he's on FOLFOX postoperatively because of the response that he had with that conversion chemotherapy.
Just out of curiosity, how long was he in the hospital and how long was your first patient with a simpler procedure in the hospital?
Yeah, first patient was in, I think I said about 4 or 5 days. This patient was in about just under a week.
Where is he right now?
He's doing well. He bounced back fairly good. He didn't bounce back as quickly as I would expect it, although he wasn't the type of individual that was exercising regularly. I found that to really affect how patients bounce back from surgery.
Was he overweight?
He was not overweight, but he was a smoker. And of course, that affects scenarios also.
I've been hearing from people, hepatic surgeons, about the issue of just being overweight without diabetes in terms of changes that occur in the liver? Is that actually significant?
Yeah, well, there are three entities, Neil, that concern me when you have resectable disease and you're thinking about giving chemotherapy before resection. And those three entities are obese individuals who we know will have a component of steatosis or steatohepatitis, severe diabetics who also will have that, and obviously cirrhotics, you know, alcohol abusers who will have cirrhotic livers. Even Bernard Nornlinger, my colleague, will say that he is very, you know, hesitant about giving those individuals perioperative chemotherapy because their normal liver is already affected. And now you add on chemotherapy to that, and you're going to make that morbidity postoperatively even worse. So obesity, I have a tendency to stay away from obese patients and giving them perioperative chemotherapy.